Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Remember Searching for Bobby Fischer, the 1993 movie about the exploits of a young chess wonderkind? Well, Netflix is winning raves for an extended chess prodigy miniseries, The Queen's Gambit. Executive producer William Holberg joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. Quibi is more than a month away from terminating its smartphone service. And when that happens, will any or all of that content get a second life on smart TV products? And where is the mega content universe with 2 months to go in 2020? Well, we'll check in for some answers with CNetNews.com senior media reporter Joan Feldman next half hour here in NYC. Also ahead, On and True TV take a dive into food TV. Believe it or not, those Tiny Toons are coming back. We got the details and our classic trivia question. Hey, everyone, I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker and TuneIn Radio, and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want, and get a free book or two when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. Great to have you with us wherever you are this Wednesday afternoon for another edition of the program all about TV's current and future. 54 degrees top of the hour. We are expecting the remnants of Hurricane Zeta, which is moving up from the Gulf of Mexico our way. We expect a lot of rain between Thursday morning and Friday afternoon. But wherever you are, we hope, if you're in the path of the storm, if you need to get out to higher ground, please do. In the meantime, we're delighted to have you here. We got a great pair of guests coming your way over the next 60 minutes, and we invite you to be part of the program. It's so simple. Pick up the phone and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's good anyway. You'll catch us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or TuneIn Radio. Chat room is open as well for you. It's SimonApple04 by name. You can find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. You know the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or TuneIn screen. Follow the instructions. Others will be live with you. Bill Holberg will join us live from Kingston, New York, after these news notes. Two cable channels will dip into the world of food fare in the coming weeks. Oprah Winfrey Network will be a two-week menu of original, of original series on that arena, November 14th, starting at noon. All four series making up this Saturday lineup, Lonely Bites, Tregay's Way, Food Fantasies, and Tanya's Kitchen Table in that order, will be hosted by African-American chefs. Now, at True TV, Fast Foodies, soon to go into production for 2021, has a pair of chefs recreate, then reimagine fast food items selected by a celebrity guest. Warner Brothers Unscripted Division Shed Media will deliver 10 episodes for True TV. Remember this theme song? They're tiny, they're toony, they're all a little loony, and they're headed back to TV sets everywhere. Tiny Toons Adventures, the anyway 1990s animated series executive produced by Steven Spielberg, is getting a two-season restart, simulcast style, on Cartoon Network and HBO Max. Spielberg will return in an executive producer role, and this go-round, the series from Warner Brothers will be called Tiny Toons Loonversity. I kid you not. Now some quickies before our first guest. Fame Toonmaker Jay Tarkovsky now has two series on his near-term WarnerMedia horizon, Season 2 of Primal on Adult Swim, and Season 1 of Unicorn, Warriors Eternal, about teen heroes, again for HBO Max and Cartoon Network. Narcos Mexico will return for a third Netflix season next year. TV One is set to play true crime original movie Blood on Her Badge, that's Blood on Her Badge, November 16th. Sony will expand syndication of People TV, the nightly series running on Meredith's own television stations in St. Louis, Atlanta, and 10 other cities. People TV will continue on the smart TV circulating service of the same name. Rob Silverstein, the former Access Hollywood executive producer who is doing People TV, was on our show earlier this fall. You can get that replay at blogtalkradio.com/televised, our homepage. And one more HBO Max item before our first guest. New British comedy sensation 2 Weeks to Live will reach Max November 5th. Game of Thrones Emmy nominee Maisie Williams co-stars. And that is news notes for today. From time to time, a television program will quietly get announced somewhere, and then and when it finally breaks loose and everyone can see it, it gets the kind of reviews, the kind of wise attention that people would just go to the ends of the earth for. Well, that is the case with Netflix's new miniseries sensation that premiered last week, The Queen's Gambit. Rotten Tomatoes has given this a 100% critics approval and 97% for its audience. The ratings are such that people are calling it not only Best New Series this fall, Best New Miniseries of 2020, but maybe Best Series, period, old or new, of 2020. And a lot of people think this will be a slam dunk for the Emmy Awards for Miniseries next summer. Joining us live from Kingston, New York, an area exclusive, the key executive producer of the Queen's Gambit, Bill Hoegler. Bill, welcome in.
Hey, thanks for having me, Simon. Good to be here.
It is a pleasure, Bill. Congratulations to you and everybody involved for how this series is going. People should know off the bat, you did produce Searching for Bobby Fischer. Do you find it deja vu that chess prodigies are coming back into your life in this way?
I did not expect to have a career that was kind of bookended by chess movies and chess series, but I'm really happy I did. You know, Searching was a very special experience. It was Steve Zaillian's debut as a writer-director, and you know, I thought he knocked it out of the park. And The Queen's Gambit was just a book that I read, you know, some 20 years ago, and I always loved it. You know, from the first page, it just hooked me in to this girl's experience, Beth Harmon. And, you know, walking in her shoes and going through everything that she went through, I found it to be one of the most compelling books I've ever read. It took a long time to get it to the screen, but it was worth it.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Zeta just joined our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Thanks for coming in. You got a question, put it over, give the call, 646-652-2906. What finally put this project over the hump, and especially to get on Netflix?
Well, in some way, Simon, I think the market had to evolve and kind of catch up to be there for the kind of show that we made. You know, we were trying to make this for a long time as a feature film, you know, a traditional 90-minute, 100-minute feature for a theatrical release. And, you know, with a chess subject matter and a young girl in the lead, it was just a tough story to find the financing for. So, you know, the book had a lot of fans over the years. I believe Bernardo Bertolucci was interested in making a version of it at one point, and Michael Apted, Walter Hill, I think Molly Ringwald, and, you know, Heath Ledger, actually, before he passed away, he had decided to make this as his first movie as a director, but none of those things, you know, came to fruition. And it was really this moment in time, you know, where streaming has, you know, really taken over the world and, you know, allowed these kind of limited series formats to happen. And Scott Frank was one of the pioneers at Netflix. You know, Godless was one of their first limited series that Scott wrote and directed. So it was a good timing for Scott and I, you know, to revisit this book that we both loved. He had a relationship with Netflix, and he was able to, you know, present it to them, and they were looking to extend their relationship with him. So it was a bit of kismet. You know, we've been pushing this rock up the hill for a long time. But it felt like, you know, its moment had finally come.
You know, two of the words that come to mind for both the critics and for viewers who have publicly talked about your miniseries is riveting and magnetic. And they just can't get enough of not only the totality of this miniseries, how it looks, how it's edited, the cinematography, the score, but also the central performance, the person who plays the Potty by the name of Anya Taylor-Joy, who a lot of people think right now is a slam dunk choice for an Emmy nomination next year.
Well, Anya is just the gift that kept on giving for us. You know, she was our first choice for the role. You know, we looked at a lot of potential candidates. Scott works with one of the best casting directors I've ever worked with, Ellen Lewis. And she presented Anya's work. We knew her a little bit, you know, from The Witch, the movie she made with Night Shyamalan. And she just seemed to have such a uncanny ability to grab and hold your interest. And, you know, we knew that this show was going to live where we had just kind of parked the camera on this character and observe her in a lot of silent moments and experience her interior life. And I think that is really what is, you know, riveting people because, you know, we knew on the page that she's in almost every scene of the story. And that, as I said, the emotional journey is really walking in her shoes as she's coming of age and growing up and not only becoming a champion in this, you know, game that she plays, but also, you know, more importantly, you know, just going through the process of trying to become who she is as a person and kind of reintegrate herself. And Anya just has that quality. You know, the camera loves her. She's one of the best young actresses of her generation. And, you know, she had the whole show on her back and she just carried it, you know, beautifully. In terms of the world of it, you know, Scott had a wonderful team. Steven Meisler was the same cinematography he worked with on Godless. Michelle Tesoro is his, you know, longtime editor. I think you're going to talk to her next week. And on the production design and costumes, we had the two top people really in Europe. Uli Hanisch is an old friend of mine. I made a movie with him 20 years ago with Cate Blanchett called Heaven. And he designed all of Tom Tykwer's movies like The Cloud Atlas and Perfume. And more recently, The Babylon Berlin, which was a show on Netflix that Scott and I are just big, big fans of. We love the look of that. You know, it managed to be a period show without having some of the pitfalls where, you know, period can somehow look a little preserved under glass and a little bit removed and artificial. And that show really had the lived-in qualities that we were looking for. So one of the first calls I made before we even had a script was to Uli and ask him to read it and meet with Scott and see if he was available. And then Gabriel Binder is a German costume designer that we met who did The Lives of Others, which was, you know, the Oscar-winning foreign film from Germany. And that was just a fantastic team. You know, we really had an A-team both in front of and behind the camera on this series who loved it and loved Scott and really, you know, came and did their best work for us.
You're hearing Bill Holberg. He is the key executive producer of Netflix's new miniseries sensation, The Queen's Gambit, that premiered last week and is getting rave reviews all over the place from both critics and viewers alike. Bill joins us live from Kingston, New York this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised, an internet radio exclusive. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Have a question or comment for Bill? Make the call 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Second of three episodes we're doing this Halloween week 2020. We got another big one for you on Friday, 90-minute edition for you. Home and Garden Television is doing some very interesting new shows with celebrities, such as the former co-star of The Sopranos, Lorraine Bracco, in a program called My Own Italian Adventure. We'll talk about that and more with HGTV Group Senior Vice President Lauren Rourke. Also, there's a new venture out called Exile Content. And the idea of Exile is to open up new English and Spanish language programming opportunities for Latinos. We will have the chief executive of that project, Alejandro Uribe, and his team member, Nando Vila, will join us. And finally, Showtime on Friday night is presenting a very neat documentary called Citizen Bio. It's about a subject you probably don't know about, but it may have a lot to do with how health and medicine and well-being will be done from here on in. It's called Biohacking. We will have the director of the program, Trish Dolan, and we may have the executive producer. He just happened to be doing a show called Snowpiercer for TNT. And before that, the Emmy Award-winning Orphan Black, Graham Mattson. But we'll be with us on Friday, 3:30 to New Pacific right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. And coming on Monday, we have a great hour for you. From the new CBS sitcom, Be Positive, from Chuck Lorre and Company, we'll have co-star Sarah Rue. It's one of the first comedies to be done under coronavirus pandemic health conditions. And it's CBS's only new series of the fall. Sarah Rue will be our lead guest. And as Bill mentioned beforehand, Michelle DeSoro, the film editor all the way through on The Queen's Gambit, also worked on Godless and the Ava DuVernay prize-winning miniseries When We See Us for Netflix. She will be our second guest on Monday. So don't miss that hour. That's next Monday, 3:30 Eastern Pacific. We kick off November right here on Tomorrow We Televise. One of the things that's very interesting, Bill, about this miniseries is how off-kilter it is. Compared to Searching for Bobby Fischer, it was a very straightforward New York-centric about this young child chess prodigy. This is a miniseries that constantly gets you off-kilter. You're constantly surprised by the characters. You're constantly surprised by the environment. And things can take a turn at any second.
Well, you know, it's a road trip story at heart. So, you know, you have someone who's kind of a displaced person. You know, she's orphaned from the first scene, which was, you know, the first page of the book. And, you know, she's institutionalized. She doesn't have a friend. She doesn't have a family. And, you know, you're watching her in situations that are, you know, very off-kilter. And I think that's why we immediately, you know, identify with her and feel for her. And, you know, at the orphanage, she both discovers that she has this incredible gift, you know, a genius for this game. But she also discovers that she has a lot of trauma. And, you know, she ends up addicted to the pills that they prescribe to her. And so the experience is her experience. And, you know, it's her journey of, you know, struggling with her addiction, struggling with her loneliness, competing in a world that has within it a built-in bias and, you know, a misogyny at its heart. You know, she's a woman struggling to kind of break through in a game that's, you know, very male-dominated and kind of clubby by tradition. And I think also Anya just had such a fantastic way of bringing unexpected choices to, you know, so many moments and so many scenes. And I think that's why, you know, people respond to it. There's just a truth to it where you don't feel like you're, you know, being served the kind of cliche version of an addiction story that, you know, we've all seen 100 times. You're really, you know, watching somebody in a truthful and kind of unexpected way, you know, who gets some benefits out of, you know, the substances that she's abusing and also, you know, pays a price. And, you know, the whole theme of the show for Scott, you know, is very much the cost of genius, you know, and to really explore what it means to have such a gift and have such a talent and how that immediately others you and makes you an outsider. And one of the great, you know, pleasures we had when we were putting the show together is we got to meet Garry Kasparov, you know, who's maybe the greatest chess player of all time. And not only was he able to consult with us in terms of the chess in the show to make sure it was really accurate and authentic and complex, but also he lived a life that wasn't unlike Beth Harmon's life. You know, he was about the same age that she would be today. He grew up in the Cold War. You know, he was discovered as a prodigious, you know, genius when he was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old. So we got to really understand the emotional journey and, you know, territory in a way that just enhanced what Walter Tevis had already excavated in his book. And I think that's why audiences are really, you know, feeling this.
Mm-hmm. This is the second miniseries that Scott Frank has put together as a writer and director. In this case, also co-creators. Godless was the first, and it's also the second time he's done a sort of a breakthrough kind of role for women, where in Godless it was all about female gunfighters, and in this case it's about a female chess prodigy who's trying to be the champion of the world in that sport. What does Scott bring to the table in terms of that background? And then what did Anya bring to her role? Because if you read Anya's resume, she has had a lot of experience with off-kilter, very unique portrayals in like science fiction films, horror films. In fact, this is the second project I know for Netflix. The first one, she was a voiceover for The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance, which won the Emmy Award this year for Best Children's Series.
Well, Scott and I go way, way back. You know, I met him when he was a young writer at Paramount in the 80s. I was the studio executive when Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson made Dead Again. So, you know, I've always been a big fan of Scott's writing. You know, he just has a gift, and he's got, you know, a really fun and unique voice. And he has that ability to both, you know, kind of find the humor in really dark and painful situations, and also, you know, put a lump in your throat, you know, in more lighthearted situations. And so, you know, he can kind of do it all from my point of view. And, you know, these scripts had that on the page, you know. And so, you know, it just seemed like a natural to me. It was Scott's idea to expand into this format, and really, you know, felt like this story was better told in this, you know, expanded version. And, you know, I just think he's got a real insight into human psychology and emotionality, and he's a real storyteller, you know, and he wants to entertain the audience, but also is rigorous in terms of, you know, his thematic underpinnings and really trying to get to the heart of the story he was telling. And he clearly found a, you know, full-bodied partner in Anya. You know, she brings that same kind of just really, really, you know, rigorous approach to character and, you know, caring about every detail and, you know, the way she walks, the way she carries herself. She had to grow up on camera, you know, from 14 years old to 22 years old in the course of, you know, whatever, the 10 or 12 weeks that we shot this. And, you know, she just has that skill. You know, she's really got a rich instrument to play.
What's it been like for you, Bill, to get back into the television game? I remember that I understand way back when you did an anthology show that ran several years on Showtime called Fallen Angels, one of the first anthology series done for cable television, pay cable TV. You have had an incredible track record of feature films, not just Searching Bobby Fischer, some of the films you mentioned, but you also did Cold Mountain, which had a certain Renee Zellweger got an Oscar for her performance as Best Actress. What's it been like for you to be part of this new wave of television where you can do a show like Queen's Gambit?
Well, here's a fun fact, Simon. Fallen Angels, since you mentioned it, Scott Frank wrote the first episode of that. And Alan Scott, who's my other producing partner that I have to mention here, he's the guy who found Queen's Gambit and optioned the book, you know, back in the 80s when it came out. So he carried this ball, you know, for 30 years, and I joined him, you know, maybe 20 years ago. So there's a bit of an origin story in Queen's Gambit that goes all the way back to Fallen Angels, because Alan Scott also wrote one of the episodes of that TV show. But this has been a fantastic experience for me. I love this format. I love the fact that it's a kind of novelistic format. It allows you to really lean into character and explore at a depth and a nuance that sometimes, you know, gets reduced when you're dealing with a three-act structure. And working with Netflix has been one of the best studio experiences I've had. You know, Cindy Holland was there when the show got bought. She bought it off the book. She totally trusted Scott and believed in him, and they gave us the resources that we need, and they were very, very supportive partners as filmmakers. You know, they never try to micromanage, but when they have creative notes, they're usually smart notes, and you want to listen to them, you know, because they're not in your face 24/7 like experiences I've had at some other studios. So the whole process of making this was one that, had a lot of love and support and gratitude at the heart of it, and I think it shows in the end product.
What's next for you, Bill? Do you want to do another television series or miniseries or continue in movies? What's next on your radar screen?
I'm agnostic. I fall in love with material and characters and stories and worlds that I want to live in. And if they lend themselves to a series format, great. If it's a limited series, great. I kind of feel like the story should dictate its format and therefore its home. I have a comedy television series that I'm starting right now to develop with another old friend of mine, Dean Craig, who wrote Death at a Funeral, a movie I made. I've got a feature film that I'm hoping to make next year that Benicio del Toro wants to do. Scott and I are talking about, teaming up to do something else, when he writes it. So it's a mixed bag, which is what I always like. It never gets boring.
And finally, what do you hope people get out of the Queen's Gambit? And what's your thoughts about the fact you've gotten this incredible surge of rave reviews from both the critics and the viewers, who just seem to be on the same wavelength, that this is a very special miniseries?
Well, Scott and I are overwhelmed. We keep texting each other at midnight going, is this really happening? And, look, we're super proud of the show. We put our hearts and guts into it. We knew that we had made something, that felt, solid and of quality. But you never know, how it's going to come out into the world and whether it's going to hit the zeitgeist. And to see it just take off like this and have this, incredibly connected, passionate response in such a mainstream way. And I'm starting to hear that it's, doing number one in Australia. It's number two in Italy. So it seems to be just working for audiences all over. And when that happens, it's just lightning in a bottle, and you kind of have to smile and ride the wave and just enjoy it. So in terms of what I hope is, obviously it's a strong statement of female empowerment. I think the fact that people, see such an unusual character as Beth Harmon in the center of a series and really seem to be responding so strongly to her character and that role. I hope in the chess world that it, spawns a whole new generation of people who get interested in that and take up that game. I hope it allows the industry to kind of support and see that, quality material like this can be mainstream and commercial, and that's, not a contradiction, that people are starving for content that, just gives more of the, human heart and human experience and how thrilling that can be. You don't have to have spaceships and Uzis in order to get a thrill. You just have to watch somebody, go through something where they change and they grow and where it's an emotional experience for you and you can identify with it. And I think that's what people that I, what I've been reading in terms of the Twitter comments and the, various websites that, real people are talking about. They don't know anything about chess, and they, don't think they would ever want to watch a show about chess. And then they, watch the first episode and they can't turn it off. And they realize that it's really not about chess. It's about the people and the relationships that she has with all of these, really interesting characters. And, I haven't talked about, but just before we go, Bill Camp, Mariel Heller, Thomas Brody Sangster, Harry Melling, Moses Ingram. You know, we just had such a beautiful, beautiful group of actors who, you know, were the supporting cast here. And every episode you get to have like a new face and a new relationship and, you know, experience her growth through these different encounters. And I think that's what also, you know, keeps it a fun ride to the very end.
Netflix is bringing you The Queen's Gambit, and a lot of people think it could be not only the best new miniseries of this fall, the best new miniseries of 2020, maybe the best TV series, period, of 2020. And you can now see it on Netflix, available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices. It is an incredible production, and I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about it both at Emmy and Peabody time next year. If you want to know more about the program, here's where you go online, www.netflix.com. It's www.netflix.com. The Queen's Gambit, now in its second week, running on Netflix. Bill Holberg, executive producer of the program, thank you again for joining us. Congratulations to you, Scott, and the cast and crew for an incredible production and all the great raves it's getting from both critics and public alike. I hope you've come through with that comedy or something new with Scott for television. It has been a wonderful delight to have you on, and we'd love to have you back anytime. It's been a terrific honor.
Thank you very much for having me and talking to me and your appreciation of the show. Thanks a lot.
You're very well. One more thing before you go. If you've never seen, for everybody, if you've never seen Search for Bobby Fischer, do find it somewhere. It is one of the best of all ages movies you will see in the 1990s, made or anywhere. A sensational film. And thank you, Bill, for making that with Stephen and everybody. It was a wonderful film watching it. And, again, great to have you on. Take care. All the greatest.
All right. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bill Holberg from The Queen's Gambit, joining us live from Kingston, New York. More drama is coming your way, and when we do, in our second half hour, Joan Silverman from CNews.com will join us, plus our classic trivia question of the week, and more. But first, we pause for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio, speakerandtunein.com, your home for the best internet radio 24/7, with more than 50 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Don't forget, DTR is your home for Hollywood Red Carpet Radio. Check it out today, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. That's Hollywood Red Carpet Radio, right here exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best BTR right here on YouTube.com. Check it out anytime. Welcome back to the second half of Tomorrow Be Televised. We're coming your way live this Wednesday afternoon of Halloween Week 2020 on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker and Tuner Radio. Also coming your way on Amazon Music and the IR Radio Podcast. Not about that. Sally Applebaum with you live from New York. And if you have a question or comment for our guest in the half hour ahead, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Joan Silverman from CNNnews.com, our classic trivia question of the week coming up, but first some words from the fine folks at Audible.com. Have you heard Matthew McConaughey has turned 50, and he's celebrating with a new audiobook called Green Lights, which he is narrating. You can get it right now with a trial run at Audible.com. If you don't know, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment, information, and inspiration. Over 200,000 titles to choose from. You can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio, Speaker Tune Radio, etc., etc., etc. If you sign up at audibletrial.com/televised, that's audibletrial.com/televised, you get one free audiobook, health and wellness material for a limited time only, and that one-month trial with great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com. And if you are already an Amazon Prime member, you have even better news. You can pick two audiobooks, including one from the growing catalog of Audible Originals. That's original audio productions, one woman, one man performances, and the best of Broadway, off-Broadway, and regional theater. So how about making this week the time that you can figure out how Audible.com can transform the way you or someone you know can hear the world? Once again, to get that one-month trial and that free audiobook or two, it's audibletrial.com/televised. Remember, it makes a great holiday gift, Halloween, Thanksgiving, anytime this upcoming holiday season. And now, joining us live from New York, one of our favorite people covering the world of television, the senior media reporter for CNNnews.com, our very good friend, Joan Salzman. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Simon. It's always great to talk to you.
Same here. So let's get into QB. You've had, along with everybody else, a week or so since the announcement that they're going dark on December 1st to hear about why. What's your thoughts?
Well, you know, when Quibi launched, I think a lot of people were skeptical, but they had a lot of wind at their back. They had a lot of money. They had big-name talent at the top. They also had gigantic talent among the programming. You know, they had all of the who's who of Hollywood involved with this project. And I think what Quibi's very quick nosedive really shows is that you having the money and having the talent isn't enough to break through as a new streaming service anymore. You really need to know your audience and know what that audience wants, and I don't think Quibi ever really understood that.
Joan, did they misread the situation with their target audience that perhaps maybe they off the bat should have used smart TV sets and smart TV devices as a backup distribution at the very least? Because we're in this era now where 80% of all U.S. households have smart TV sets and smart TV devices. That includes most communities of color, most people of color, except all different demographic groups. They're watching tens of billion hours of content and apps a month. It's growing incredibly. We now have all these new streaming services that have come on in the last 4 or 5 months, mostly from new players, some from people of color. Did they misread the vote here?
I think they definitely did, and that goes not only for not supporting television sets, but for other things too. To your point, Quibi was mobile only at launch. They didn't anticipate how much people really want to watch programming on their television sets, which is also particularly odd given that they were making shows that were short form, yes, but the budgets per minute for these shows were huge. They had really high production values. And it's quizzical to, I think, a lot of people why you would only allow your viewers to watch that on the smallest screen that they have and not have at least the option of watching it on a big screen at launch. You know, they had a premise about being able to deliver short-form, little, quick-bite content on phones. But, of course, the premise of that began to unravel. If it wasn't already flawed, it began to unravel as they launched at the beginning of this pandemic, when everyone was in North America was starting to lock down and be stuck in their homes. You know, they didn't have those opportunities when they're waiting at a bus stop or waiting in a coffee line to watch these short snippets of video. But, you know, beyond that, there's also other things, other strategic misfires that they did. They didn't anticipate the ability to share this stuff socially. They didn't let you screenshot anything on your phone from the programming. So if there was something that you thought was memeable or should be, you know, water cooler talk on social media, it was really hard to do that because you couldn't take snippets of the programming or even screenshots of it to share. There are a lot of things that I think they didn't understand about what the audience would demand when they launched it, and you can see that in some of the things they tried to roll out later, but it was too little too late.
Some critics have said that something else that Quibi did not do was to learn the lessons of Verizon Media's Go 90 a year or two earlier when they tried a similar type of thing and they bombed. The other thing is we had Lee Hunt, one of the top marketing people in television, who was a very big strategic consultant in that vein, who we had on our show last week, is that while Quibi had that big Super Bowl spot and they had the big presentation at CES this past January, they didn't do a lot of promotion, marketing, public relations to let people know what are the shows before it actually premiered. You didn't see a lot in terms of attention given to these programs. And it seemed to be a little bit of a telltale sign that Janice Min, the former editor of The Hollywood Reporter, who was a major player there, left a couple weeks before the launch, and so did their head of marketing.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not a marketing expert, so I'll defer to your guest from last week about that. But, I mean, certainly you're absolutely right in the sense that they didn't market the individual shows necessarily. They definitely put their talent out there front and center. You know, they had Chance the Rapper in spots, I believe. Who else did they have in ad spots? They had some big talent that showed up in some of those. They had Sophie Turner from Game of Thrones in one. So they put their talent out there, but they didn't actually get the message across in their marketing about what you would actually be watching when you signed up for it. They kind of assumed that they would have people sign up for it and become so addicted to their programming that they would stick with it and continue to feed that appetite. But it doesn't really, especially with the inability to share socially, it doesn't really, you know, how are new people going to find it? Is marketing really your only way, and the marketing isn't even targeting the people that you're going after? And, you know, beyond that, if they're going after people that are going to be watching something primarily on their phone, and they're going to be watching short-form content, why would you be advertising it for the Super Bowl? I mean, that definitely gets people's attention, but Quibi never wanted for attention. It got so much press because it had so much money backing it, so many big-name investors, and big-name, you know, executives at the top. They didn't need attention. They needed to communicate to their viewers what they could get, and they clearly didn't do that to the degree that they expected to.
Now, we're talking about a $2 billion venture, incidentally. Let's answer the question we posed at the top of the last half hour, Joan, which is if you read into what both Jeffrey Katzenberg and Mae Whitman said in their interviews to Deadline Hollywood Daily and then on CNBC, there's a sense that there's an awful lot of programming out there that was produced and an awful lot of programming in development. Is there a chance that any or all of that could get a second life through a smart TV set or a smart TV device service, or through a Netflix, or through an Amazon, or through a Disney Plus, et cetera?
Yeah, I believe, as far as I know, you know, this is something I followed up with Quibi about because a lot of people are curious, you know, what's the afterlife of this programming? And I think what the most likely outcome is, and this is just speculation, but from what I understand, Quibi didn't own any of these shows. It essentially paid for people to make them and then licensed it back for a short-term period. I believe the period is usually 2 years. So it would have an exclusive on this programming for a two-year period, and then the rights to that programming revert back to the production companies that were behind it. So feasibly what we could see is at the, you know, the edge case is that in 2 years after launch, all this programming gets to go back to the people that made it, and they can decide if they want to license it to Netflix, if they want to just put it out for free on YouTube, if they want to launch their own little app, if they produce a lot of content that's evergreen, if they want to, you know, launch their own little programming app. Why not? Who knows? But I think one thing that is unclear is we don't exactly know, at least I don't know yet, what does the dissolution of Quibi mean for those agreements to give Quibi an exclusive window if Quibi doesn't exist anymore. So I think absolutely you're going to see some of this programming pop up again. I think some of it might just disappear. The question is, how long do we have to wait to see what the afterlife of this programming really is?
And especially the shows in development, whether or not they're to stay short form, if they do come to life, or whether they will go half hour, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Joan, one more thing before we leave the subject of Quibi, at least for this half hour. Quibi had a lawsuit against Echo, the interactive programming service that has Samsung and Walmart as major investors, that they still have not gone on Samsung's on smart TV sets and devices. And when we've had guests on talk about why haven't they put on, they say this lawsuit was a big deal. Now that Quibi is going dark December 1st, does Walmart, does Samsung have the green light to finally put Echo, which you can get on smartphones, you can get on tablets, you can get on PCs, does it finally give Echo the opportunity to put their interactive service on the TV set?
Oh, interesting. Echo was saying that this lawsuit against Quibi was preventing it from having support on Samsung smart TVs?
Well, it was thought that that's why Echo did not go on, because Samsung's a major investor, they're the major smart TV set maker. One would have thought they wouldn't.
I see what you're saying. There's speculation about, conflict, sort of. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's something I don't really know. That's a really great question. But what we do know is that Echo isn't backing down from its lawsuit against Quibi. Even though Quibi is going to be dissolving and, you know, is in the process of trying to sell off what remaining assets it has to return that money back to investors, one of those assets isn't necessarily this turnstile technology that's at the center of this lawsuit with Echo, because Echo has said, look, just because Quibi says they're quitting doesn't mean that our litigation against them ends. And so that means if turnstile were to be something that Quibi wanted to sell in order to return that money to investors, it would have to be selling it with this huge cloud hanging over it of potentially expensive litigation. So that kind of, if nothing else, that takes some of the wind out of the sails of this technology that Quibi really just praised to high heaven. They're not going to be able to recoup any of their effort or work in that unless they find a buyer that's really willing to take a risk on something so risky.
Yeah, we did see if this technology lawsuit goes away and finally the green light goes for Echo to finally go on smart TV sets and devices, where a lot of people think it belongs, or whether it lingers for past 2020 into 2021 or beyond. We'll have to wait and see. Joan Saltzman is our guest this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised, live from New York. She is the senior media reporter for CNNnews.com. Does a great job with that. We've had her on the show before, and we're happy she is on this half hour. You can give her a call right now, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04. Remember, coming up on Monday, we've got a great hour to kick off November for you. We've got Sarah Rue, one of the co-stars of the new CBS sitcom, Be Positive, from Chuck Lorre. It's the first CBS program in terms of comedy that they're doing under the coronavirus pandemic. That is brand new. And we understand that they're going to be their only new program that they're launching in prime time this fall. So it'll be interesting to hear what Sarah has to say about that. And then the film editor from The Queen's Gambit, also worked on Godless, also worked on the Emmy-winning Ava DuVernay miniseries of last year, When They See Us, Michelle Tesoro. That's all coming up Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. Dynamite Hour in store for you right here exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. John, we're a little more than 2 months away to the end of 2020. Where do you see this mega programming cycle going? By mega programming service, I'm talking, of course, about Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus. They both mark their first anniversary next month. We've got HBO Max, we've got Peacock, we have BET Plus, and we're going to have Paramount Plus coming out of CBS All Access early next year.
I know. It is an explosion of streaming programming. Even, you know, with all of these restrictions and, well, first all the shutdowns on production and now restrictions on production, streaming is definitely one place where there's going to be a glut of programming for people to turn to. I think that Friday, with the launch of The Mandalorian second season on Disney Plus, that'll give us a sense of just how much people in this lockdown pandemic time have started to turn to streaming services beyond just Netflix. I mean, you know, Netflix is the big kahuna. It's the big one. And so it always has, you know, bazillions of people watching. It'll be interesting to see how the reception to The Mandalorian second season compares to the first one, you know, if it reflects the fact that people have been cutting that cord, have been moving over to streaming alternatives, and if that really big breakout hit can still generate the same or even more level of interest. I think that'll be telling for how you know, TV and video viewers, how they've changed their habits.
It also seems that we are going to see more of an emphasis on original content and less on library content. I mean, you can't go a day without deals that either program development deals with a certain content creator or content company, whether it's for Warner Brothers, whether it's for Peacock, whether it's for Apple TV, whether it's for Lionsgate, whether it's for Sony. It just comes all over the place. And you get this sense that now that programs are being produced here in New York, Los Angeles, all over, that we are bound for an incredible explosion of original shows on all these services.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Netflix in particular, you know, the fact that Netflix makes their programming, they make their programming to suit their binge model, right? They drop all episodes on day one. That's meant that Netflix in particular has had a much longer pipeline of completed work. You know, they said that they're not even going to have to slow down maybe a title here or there, but all of their slate is unchanged for this year. It probably is going to be the same for the beginning of next year. But we are seeing some difficulty in other streaming services. You know, Peacock was supposed to be launching with the Olympics, and a lot of content related to the Olympics and all that stuff had to be put on ice until the Olympics eventually happen. And so I think that's hard for people, for new services that are trying to break through, when you can't have the same cadence of new programming coming out as a big kahuna like Netflix, then it's really difficult.
Yeah. At the same time, Joan, we are seeing this new cycle because of executive realignment at WarnerMedia, at Disney, at NBCUniversal, at ViacomCBS over the last month and a half. We have got this group of free agents, super, super talented creative people in free agency. Bob Greenblatt, a Kevin Reilly, a Cindy Holland, other Netflix executives, Mark DeRevoir, the person who formerly ran CBS All Access and CBS Interactive. They're all free agents. Where are they all going to go?
They're probably some are going to go to startups, and some are just going to, you know, play musical chairs with their, you know, former colleagues at other companies. I mean, like, you saw this with Plessler, with Richard Plessler at HBO, owned by Time Warner, owned by AT&T. He wasn't satisfied with the amount of autonomy that HBO would have under, you know, a telecom giant as its parent company. And so he defected, ending up with this kind of sweetheart deal with Apple TV Plus. So the fact that there is so much programming happening, and especially the fact that, you know, Quibi aside, most of these new services, these new streaming services creating programming, they're back with deep pockets. You know, Apple, AT&T, we're talking about Disney, of course. These are companies that can spend a lot of money, and they're willing to make that investment now in order to have a really robust offering to get people's attention and to keep them interested. And so definitely you're going to see people going, you know, kind of trading, playing musical chairs, maybe some people get some more sweetheart deals from some of these, you know, war chests that these giant companies have. And you'll probably see other ones feel, you know, compelled to live out some startup dreams and start up a teeny tiny company to try to break things up. Maybe, I don't know, maybe they'll all be dissuaded because they saw how Quibi failed. But I guess it remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. One more thing, Joan. I can't believe this hour is flying fast. It's been amazing. And, of course, you always make it amazing when you're here, is that we're also seeing these new packagers of new plumbing services on smart TV sets and smart devices really come into their own. Cinedigm, Jukin Media, which is more toward user-generated content and putting them into various categories like the Pet Collective. We have Future Today, which is doing a lot of family programming. Cinedigm has this new horror service that just came out. They're working on a women's network called My Time. They've got a multicultural scripted network that's coming out before the end of the year, early January. A Party Crashers network with the Young Turks folks, sort of progressive political plumbing different ways. What do you make of these companies that are, in a way, also trying to become new players in this whole, you know, era of smart TV?
Yeah, I think it's definitely really interesting. A lot of the headlines and a lot of attention goes to these gigantic streaming services that launch with, you know, from these humongous companies. But I think that these smaller, more niche channels, apps, and services are really interesting. And my take on them is that a lot of them, they're based around a fandom. And not all fandoms are created equal. Some of them are a fandom that doesn't manifest enough for a niche version of a streaming service. And others really do. You know, like anime, for example, is one that we've seen, you know, things like Crunchyroll, services like that that specialize in anime. What we've learned from the fact that that's a service that's continued to, you know, over the course of something like 10 plus years, continue to survive, even as this market has changed so much and become so much more competitive, because that anime fan really suits somebody that's willing to pay for access to a lot of content which already exists. That's not the only thing that you need in order for one of these niche services to be successful, but those are the kinds of things that really go into it. Do you have a giant reservoir of content that your audience can then dive into after maybe they come in for one show, maybe it's a new show, maybe it's not. They come in for one thing. Is there an iceberg underneath that peak sticking out of the water that they can really start to explore and make it worthwhile for them to stick around with a service that you're going to be, you know, in most of these cases, paying for a small amount every month? It really does come down to the audience and whether you can deliver what they want over a long haul.
It's just so amazing, Joan, that we're seeing, and despite this pandemic, we are seeing this incredible tidal wave of new services from new players that many of them are people of color, women of color, that are trying to make it into television and using smart TV sets and smart devices as their circulation, distribution tool to do it. And I'm sorry we're running out of time, but I wish we could get to Paramount Plus, because I think the try to convert next time we have you on, we have to talk about Paramount Plus, because I think that's going to be a very interesting sleeper story to see CBS All Access try to go to the next super level as a mega service with Paramount Plus. You can check your own work anytime you like at CNetNews.com. Just news.com is all you need to do, And I promise you, it's really, really great reading. Joan, thanks again for all the great time and the thoughts. Let's do this again before the year is out. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to hear all your thoughts on Paramount Plus next time.
You got the day. Take care. Have a super rest of the week.
You too. Bye-bye.
Joan Feldman from CNNnews.com joining me here in New York. Time now for our classic trivia question of the week. We first had it for you on Monday, and we're still looking for our third weekly winner in a row. If you're first with the correct answer, you will win a wonderful book called Hitman, 40 years making music, topping charts, and winning Grammys, the memoir of the legendary classic music producer David Foss, who's worked with everybody from Dionne Warwick to Celine Dion, Whitney Houston, Barbra Streisand, and more. Here's the question. In what year did the Grammy Awards ceremony go live on television? In what year did the Grammy Awards go live on TV? If you know the answer, email me, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. It's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. And remember, enclose your name and your full name and address. If you're first with the correct answer, you win Hitman by David Foster, published by Pocket Books. And you'll become our third weekly winner in a row. And if you don't get a winner by the end of today, we'll post the question tomorrow morning on Facebook, Simon Applebaum, and on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's UBC Simon TWBT. So remember, in order to win, play in. If you won before, please let somebody else do it for the very first time. The more winners, the merrier. One last time the question, what year did the Grammy Awards go live on TV? SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Again, thank you to Joan Feldman. Thank you to Bill Hobart for being with us. And, of course, best of luck with the Queen's Gambit and the future projects for wherever they will be in television and film. Don't forget, we have a 90 edition coming your way on Friday. Joining us will be from Home and Garden Television, Group Senior Vice President Lauren Roach, from Exile Content, Chief Executive Alejandro Uribe, and team member Nando Vila, and from the new Showtime documentary produced on Friday night, Citizens Bio, we'll have director Trish Dolan and maybe executive producer, also with, of course, Snowpiercer and Orphan Black, Graham Matson. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up on episodes you missed, very simple, go to our homepage anytime you like, blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. And don't forget to check out our podcast. You can check all our episodes from this month and earlier at iTunes, Apple TV, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, iHeart.com, and, of course, TuneIn Radio at TuneIn.com, too. Love to hear what your thoughts are about the world of television, where it's at, where it's going. And did you have a chance to see The Queen's Gambit? Love to hear what you think about that wonderful show, too. So email me or find me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and on LinkedIn as well. Well, however you reach me, I do reach back to you within 24 hours. Why? Because, as always, what you say matters. The views expressed here are those of the participants, not merely those of Blog Talk Radio and other distributors of this program. Our production associate is Mandolin. Andy Toe is Blog Talk Radio's general manager. Jay Sotler is head of content. And the co-founders are Al Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow we tell about it's brought to you by Audible.com and Amazon Division. Remember, Audible transforms the way you hear the world. For that 1 month trial, 1 or 2 free audiobooks. Remember, if you're an Amazon Prime customer, it's 2. And other health wellness material, just go to audibletrial.com/televised. Makes a great gift for you or someone you love this holiday season. For Tomorrow We Televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you, Felix. Have a great rest of your midweek. We'll be back on Friday, less than 48 hours from now. That's 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, and you know where. Broad Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, Amazon Music, and the iRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're up to between now and then, please make it safe, make it great. If you're in the eye of a hurricane or what hopefully will be tropical depression, whatever is Zeta, by the time it reaches here in the Big Apple tomorrow, please, if you need to go to higher ground, do. Let's all get through this together, and let's lift this pandemic now and forever. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.